racing is kind of tough. Like, if you like riding your bike, racing sucks. If riding your bike is what you love to do,
yeah,
racing BMX sucks. And a great example I'll give, bike parks, if you want to, if you live in Denver, Colorado, you want to blow your mind. You need to move to Denver. Now, granted, you can't ride much in the winter, but here's the thing. If you live on the north side of Denver, there's 8 Velo Solution pump tracks on the north side of Denver.
Jesus.
If you live in the right spot, you're within 45 minutes of 8 different Velo Solution pump tracks. Then you got your dirt jump parks on top of that. So every year, like now when I sell shirts, what I do is every track has state qualifiers. So I'm like, hey, where do I want to go ride? Oh, Boise has a kick-ass pump track. One of the state races in Boise. Oh, Denver has a bunch of places to ride. One of the state races in Colorado in the Denver area, you know? So, like, that's usually what I do is I go up there, sell shirts on the weekend. You know, sometimes I can make it a trip. Like, I do one weekend, sell shirts, ride all week, sell shirts next weekend. Hopefully, I sell enough to pay for the trip and or maybe make a little or help pay for the trip. And then I got to ride for a week for fun. You know, I got to have a blast.
Yeah.
I mean, Denver has got so many places to ride for free, but I don't know. I'd have to probably sit down with some of the Denver local track operators and see if having all the places to ride hurts.
That's a great
their
question.
Local program or hurt. I mean, that's really the, and who knows, maybe we'll find out when USA BMX builds that track. That's, so I asked Justin, I'm like, you got like a pump line and then you can use the BMX racetrack turn and then back to here and split off. And he's like, well, we did that so you'd have as much variety to ride during the day. But he's like, you know, we're going to only be racing 6 hours a week. You know, if we race a few races, the track is, you know, the facility's closed. It's racing only for this 2 hour, 3 hour, 4 hour block, three days a week. The rest of the time, it's open to do whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so that helps. I mean, heck, I mean, like I said, Tuesday night, there's a pump track they built in Fountain Hills. It's at 25 minutes from my house. I got off of work. I went out there and the lights don't, I think the lights shut off at 10 p.m.
I know
they were still on at about 9:45 when I left. But I went out there and I pumped for an hour.
See,
and I did it. I came home, I ate, did whatever, relaxed. Okay, I'm going to go ride the pump track for an hour, work on some skills, do whatever, get back.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, for you, I get that idea that you're looking not for a pump track, you're looking for a practice track. You know, and you need places to ride. And again, if there were pump tracks more readily available, would kids just ride and never want to race because they don't want to pay to race? But people want competition.
Yeah,
I think that's really what it is.
Yeah.
Why do you race?
I love the competition and the camaraderie.
So the camaraderie you can get without having to race.
Without having to race too, though. That's true. So you know what I've been led to do? I'll just be 100% about it. There are days when I get off work late. I just jump on my bike and just ride the curb cuts on the streets. I just go out. So I'll ride from my house in Lake Worth Beach, and then ride to downtown West Palm and turn around. But I'm riding the curb cuts just to work on manuals and stuff like that.
Right.
So because there's no pump track for me to hit. And what was crazy was when I was back home living in Minneapolis, man, we end up moving. So there was a pump track out in Cottage Grove. So it's a suburb. Okay. So great pump track. But when I get off work, it's kind of hard. You get out there and you probably only got like 35, 40 minutes. So come to find out, soon as we move down here, they build a pump track in North Minneapolis, but it's right by the highway. So I could have just hit that.
Yeah.
But now I'm down here. So it's difficult for me.
And that's the thing. I mean, the problem with BMX tracks is, I mean, there's still some open tracks out there.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's like you have a 2 hour block Tuesday night to ride it. And depending on your work schedule, maybe you can only get out there and ride for an hour. Sometimes you're like, man, I want to get to the track, but I got to stress and get here and get there. I might only get an hour. Is it worth for me to go to the track just get an hour's riding time in?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not worth it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have that facility that you can ride whenever, and you can plan your schedule. Again, I mean, the bike park we have, in, I call it Mesa Bike Park, but it's technically Desert Trails Park. It's full slurry. They have like five-inch layer of slurry, and they have wood kickers. But I know that if it rains, sometimes when it rains, it's kind of built on a hill. There'll be debris from the hill that'll wash into like the track. Yeah. And it's just like sand. You just got to sweep it off. So when it gets bad, I'll just go out there. If I know it rained really hard and I want to go ride the next day, I'll just go out there, take a broom, sweep off whatever, and I'm riding. So yeah. I know it's going to always be rideable, you know? And it's like, I can plan out like, hey, I'm off on Monday. I'm going to go ride from, you know, like middle of the summer, it gets really hot, you know, here in Phoenix, morning. You know, 110. So I'm like, dude, I'll go out and ride from 8 to 9. Just get an hour in, do my thing, get back. You know, it's 20 minutes from my house. It's easy to do. And you can kind of keep up on it.
Not bad. Tell me this, Style Industries. Is it still going? How's it going?
No. No, it's done pretty much. I mean, I sell shirts. Like, I don't sell a brand anymore. I just sell BMX-inspired t-shirts.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we are pretty much – I got divorced 3 years ago, I think, now. And it was kind of like we kind of just disbanded everything and did whatever, you know, type of deal. It's just – owning your own business is hard. Yeah. And owning a business in the BMX world is even harder.
Why?
Yeah. BMX is a hobby niche sport. I mean, that's if I could, I don't want to be Debbie Downer or whatever, but if I could give advice to anybody listening to this show, I would just say BMX is a hobby niche sport and accept that. Accept that. BMX is a hobby niche sport. And if you're doing it for fun and you're enjoying it and it's good for you, it gives you a release, it's a hobby, cool. If it could start to consume your life and consume your finances,
yeah,
it's time to back off. You know, because in the end, I mean, there's a couple people that are going to be able to make a career or have made a career out of racing BMX.
Yeah.
You know, Connor Fields will be able to parlay his gold medal for a long time. Yeah. But if he didn't win that gold medal, would he be hosting a TV show for like Utah, whatever he's doing now? Like, would he be hosting that show?
It's Outdoor Nevada. I just interviewed
Outdoor Nevada. Would he be hosting that show if he didn't have a gold medal? Like, if he never won an Olympic medal, would he be hosting that show? Highly doubt it. You know, but that gold medal gives him that. But there's only three people that have ever won, three men that have ever won a gold medal. And only three women have won a gold medal in BMX. You know, I don't think the women, Mariana Pajon might be able to do some stuff with it, you know? I mean, Elise Willoughby, I think, is doing good financially. And Ellis obviously did good back in the day. But outside of that, you know, not many pros made money worthwhile. So, I mean, BMX is a hobby niche sport. And as long as you accept that,
yeah,
business wise, like how many BMX companies are actually making it?
I'm curious of that.
There's a couple. I mean, I talked to a guy that's owned a prominent BMX, couple BMX brands, and I was talking to him 3 years ago and telling him how great it was to deliver packages for Amazon. I'm like, yeah, dude, I work 40, 50 hours a week. I collect a paycheck almost with a comma in it, you know, like. When it's Christmas time, I'm collecting a comma every week, you know, comma in the check. That's over $1,000. And
yeah,
he's like, yeah, man, I know what you mean. And he's run these companies for 10, 15 plus years. He's like, dude, I rent a house. I got no wealth. I'm maybe making 50 grand a year and I'm working all the time. You know, I think he's doing better now, but you know, and if I don't want to say who it is,
no,
people might be able to put it together, but it's like very few BMX companies are actually making a profit.
We'll be right back.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
okay, when I hear that, here's the thing that kind of trips me out, Colin. I'm thinking that BMX is all over the world.
How many people race BMX in the world?
That's a great question.
How many people race BMX in the United States?
Great question. I would love to.
You don't know?
I don't know, to be very honest with you.
You don't get on No Holds Barred much?
No.
On the Facebook page? Henry Saria? I mean, the numbers are out there. The numbers are out there if you want to look for it.
Yeah.
There's it's low 30s. And that's wow. Just, and that's everybody. That's everybody. The hardcore race market is maybe 10,000 strong.
Really?
Maybe 10,000 strong. So if you're a BMX company and you make a badass product that everybody has to have, you can't sell more than 10,000 of them. If you get 25% of the market share, you'll sell 2,500 items.
See, this is why I asked to talk to you, because I don't know this stuff.
And the thing is, I actually discovered that early on, because I did transit, and I was like, when I first bought transit, I bought it from another guy who did it before me.
Yep, yep.
And he did all BMX, he did freestyle, flatland, racing, all this kind of stuff. And when I got the company, I just said, you know what? I'm just going full race. That's what I know. I'll do some trails, you know, sections here and there.
Yeah.
And maybe some park sections here and there, but I'm not going out of my way to do that. I'm going to just focus on racing. But when I bought the company, I'm like, I got to come up with two numbers. Number one, how many videos can I realistically sell? I know I'm not going to sell a million of these things, but like, where's my ceiling?
Yep.
Like, if I'm hitting hard, what's my ceiling? And I went off of there, and how I got my original number, I thought 6,000 videos an issue was my ceiling, because I looked at ABA said they had, you know, 40 to 60, NBL said they had this many. Between both sanctioned, there's 60,000 people. If I hit 10%, 6,000 is my max. That's my ceiling. That was my early numbers. That was my early numbers. And then I said, how many videos do I got to sell to break even? Because it costs a lot of money to travel. Equipment. I mean, back then I had $20,000 in camera equipment, early 2000s. Nowadays, that $20,000 in camera equipment, you could get for $1,000.
Yeah.
Or you could just use an iPhone. Like, you know, technology's come down, but to have a good mini DV camera was $3,500, just the camera. You have a case, I mean, you're spending $4,500 in the camera. And then the computer power, you're spending $4,000 on a computer, you're spending $2,500 on the editing software. Now that editing software is free, the computers are way cheaper. I mean, heck, people are editing stuff on their cell phones nowadays, you know, so technology's come down.
Yeah.
You know, and then you got your travel expense. You look at all that and I'm like, you know, to know what my ceiling is for sales is harder number to figure out. To know what I got to sell to break even is easy. I just do a few videos. I can calculate how much money I spent doing those videos, you know, just before I even. And people are like, oh, well, you can get them duplicated cheaper. I'm like, the duplication cost is not the problem. Before I am ready to put that video out, I'm $5,000 in. Between travel, equipment, supplies, everything, I'm $5,000 in to do that video.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, and then I look at ordering 2,000 videos. And I figured 2,000 was my break-even point. So I'm like, originally, I'm like, okay, 6,000 is my ceiling. 2,000's break even.
And yeah.
You know, and my best selling one, well, my How to Race DVD was my best seller, but in the Transit series, like number four was my best. And I just looked at what I sold for the 6 months. I mean, I would sell as they go along, but whatever I sold, because I did two videos a year. So I kind of looked at like what I did for that year.
Yeah.
You know, not 6 months, but about a year, you know, and I hit about 2,500. On TR4. And I went from like number two. Number one, I didn't produce that one.
Yeah.
And there's a long story. I didn't like the way that video came out. So I didn't really want people knowing about that video. But then I started off with Transit Race 2, even though there technically wasn't a labeled Transit Race 1, but there was one. But I did 2 because other people were starting to do stuff. I wanted people in the market to know that, hey, you know, I'm doing videos. You know, this is my first one. But you know, I hit like 1800 in the first year on transit race two, and then three, I got up to like 22, and I'm up to 2400. I'm like, okay, we're in the sweet spot. Keep going. Transit race five, I came down about 2300. I came down a little bit. I'm like, huh, that's weird. I'm like, maybe people didn't like Jason Richardson, you know, because every video I would showcase a pro. We did Kyle Bennett on number two, Randy Stumphauser number three, Nate Berkheimer on number four, and then number five, we did Jason Richardson. So I'm like, oh, maybe people don't like Jason Richardson. And then number six comes out, and my sales dropped a little bit more. And then seven came out, so my ceiling was 2,400, you know? And, you know, there was two conversations that kind of got me going. One of them was Chad Roberts, who worked for Shimano. He was a vet pro. He worked at Shimano. So he was in it. And Shimano's a huge company.
Yep.
And we were sitting and staging at Rockford. And he's all like, he's like, dude, he goes, I mean, the hardcore race market's 10,000 strong. And he's like, you know, so explaining that. And he's like, I'm like, yeah, but he's like, dude, I work for Shimano. They're a huge company. They've done the market research. And Shimano realizes that the hardcore race market is 10,000 strong. So Shimano has to be careful if they make a BMX specific product, because they have a limit on what they can sell. Their limit is not really worth it. But if they make a product that can work for mountain biking and racing BMX, then it works, because they're just getting extra sales with what they already have. But to create a product that's just for BMX, they had to be cautious in how much they put into that. And that made me think, like, wow, if 10,000 is the race market and I sold 2,500 videos, that's 25%. And when you think about it, with a video, I'm not getting more than 25%, because you don't have to have that video to race. And a lot of people buy the video and borrow it to their friends. So it's like, if I got 25% of the hardcore race market, I'm doing pretty damn good, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm not doing good because I'm just making a little bit of money. Like, I'm not really above where I need to be. I'm not close to that 6,000, you know? And then going back to the 60,000, I thought there were 60,000 members. So fast forward to, I actually had this conversation at Black Mountain in the pits with a guy named Greg Hill. If you ever heard of Greg Hill?
Come on, man. Yes.
I get this a lot from people that are like, hey, how come you don't do transit anymore? And I just, if for people that are watching the video, I'm doing the money sign. I couldn't afford to do it anymore. And the moment I knew transit was done was after I moved to Arizona in 05. Christmas was coming up. And my ex-wife, she used to print everything for the ABA, all the t-shirts. So we did over $100,000 a year in shirts for the ABA back then. So it was a lot of money. And so we were doing the shirts. Anyways, ABA was having a company Christmas party, and BA needed somebody to babysit his kids. So he'd go to the Christmas party, and my future stepdaughter got voluntold that she was going to babysit. So we had to go over there to drop her off because she was like 14. Mm-hmm. And we're waiting for BA's wife to get ready. And I'm sitting in BA's kitchen having a conversation with them. If people don't know, BA Anderson, CEO, whatever, his dad owns ABA, USA BMX. He's the main boss. And we're having a conversation about whatever. And he goes, well, you know, the NBL only has 13,000 members. And this was in 05. And I'm like, no, they're like 20 to 30. He goes, no, they're 13. They're 13.5. I think he said 13.5. I'm like, no, they're 20. And the third time I corrected BA, he stopped me and said, dude, I almost bought their company in 2002 for a couple million bucks. I know what their numbers are. I've seen all their books. And people don't know, in 2002, ABA almost bought the NBL from USAC for a couple million dollars. Did you know that story?
No.
No, yeah, that was an interesting little story. Basically, USAC, which is USA Cycling, was kind of tight on money, and they owned the rights to NBL. So they were trying to come with some money. So they offered selling the NBL to the ABA back in 2002. And they did a preliminary vote with the board, and it went through. And then when Clayton John, CEO of ABA at the time, found out, he flew to Florida to have a meeting with Alice Bixler. who basically runs the NBL. I mean, Bob Tedesco ran the NBL back then, but Alice Bixler controlled one third of the NBL because she was atop of Florida. And Clayton John was smart enough to know, like, hey, if we're going to drop a couple million dollars to buy the NBL, I want to make sure there's not mutiny. So that's why he went to Sarasota and sat down. It's like, Alice, I need to sit down and have a talk with you. They went to dinner. And he started the conversation by, I'm sure by now you know that we're in negotiations to buy the NBL. Alice had no clue. I don't think anybody at the NBL had clue what was going on. And then that started a whole crazy upheaval. And at the same time, things got even crazier because ABA had just sold their national bike vending rights to Pro Bike Parts so that at the Nationals, there was only going to be one bike vendor selling stuff. And at the time, they were getting two trailers done. So there was like a rumor like, well, why are you doing? And everybody in the BMX world knows everybody. And I think Linda Dorsey, supposedly the story I heard, Linda Dorsey got a bid because she ran stickers for stickering up trailers and did like vinyl graphic stuff like that. If you guys know Linda Dorsey, that was the story I heard. I don't know what she did. I know she announced and whatnot, but I don't know. But that was the story I heard, is they got a bid for two trailers. Well, if they're doing only one national series, why would they need two trailers? And so then they started to be like, oh, there's going to be one sanction, this and that. Things went crazy. Anyways, the sale didn't happen. And, sale didn't happen. And so that's how, when BA said to me, I almost bought their company a few years ago. I saw all their books. I know what they have.
Yeah.
I had to take a step back and be like, man, is this true? And so then I went to the Christmas Classic right after that, because the Christmas party, Christmas Classic, I'm filming for Transit. And I'm there filming for Transit. And I also have a thing of, hey, I need to talk to some NBL board people and find out if that's the true number. Is 13.5 the true number? So I talked to a few people on the board. They're like, no, we're 25 to 30. I'm like, no, this is who told me. And this is how he told me he knew what it was.
Yeah.
And then I finally, and they're all like, they're just, oh, no, we're 25 to 30. But I could tell that their answer wasn't like they really knew. They were just telling what everybody else had told them. They were just repeating what it. And so then I finally met a guy that used to work at the NBL that wasn't there anymore. I'm like, yo, David, between you and me, this is a story I heard. Is this true? And he goes, yep. And it was like, whoa. I knew right there I was basically done with Transit. I knew right there that Transit was a dead end. And here's the thing. So I'm sitting in the pits and I told that story to Greg Hill. At this part of the story, Greg Hill responds to me. This is Greg Hill's response. So you mean the ABA was only 27,000? Now here's the thing. How did, because I said 13.5, how did Greg Hill come up with the number 27?
Great question.
What's 13.5 times 2? 27. And if you ever dealt with the sanction, main marketing guy, he always talked about, why would you go to the NBL? We're twice as big as the NBL. ABA in the industry, when they were talking to industry people, they always like, we're twice as big, we're twice as big, we're twice as big, we're twice as big. So what BA doesn't understand, when he told me NBL's true number, he indirectly told me ABA's true number.
Yeah, yeah.
And Greg just did the simple math. He just multiplied it by 2. And then I looked at Greg and I was like, yeah, but I had to be more precise than that. And back then, the BMXer went out, the American, the ABA's membership magazine. Yep. And in the back of that magazine was district points. And anybody who had a membership and raced once collected a district point. So I picked up a magazine from the end of the year and I just counted how many names were on a page and how many pages there were. And it was about 25,000. And that includes people that have a cruiser and a 20. So some people are counted twice. You got to think about that. So then when you look at it, it's like, wow, there might be 30,000, 35,000. So 10% of that's 3,500.
Yeah.
So depending how you do the numbers. And the thing is, you got to remember, this is something people don't realize about BMX. There's a huge turnover in the sport.
Yes.
Huge turnover. At one time, I was an Orlando local. And like I said before, I was a Universal local. I went to other tracks.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was at Orlando pretty consistently, weekly for a while. And then I quit going there for like a year and a half. I got into going to other tracks and went back to Orlando, and I hadn't been there in a year and a half, and I'm practicing and I'm looking around. And I know like five people. And I'm like, dude, when I was here before, I knew like 30, 40 people, but now I only know five. And I realized, damn, I haven't been here in a year and a half. So a lot of people I knew are gone. If you're there consistently, you don't realize the people that drop off because there's new people to meet.
Yeah.
So you're constantly teaching clinics. We would go teach a clinic and go back to that track the next year. No, like we would see all new people. We might see one person we saw the year before. There's so much turnover. And the thing is with BMX, how many people come into the sport, sign up, get a membership, race three times and quit? I would bet half of the people that sign up don't make it three races.
Okay, so then what is needed to keep BMX on a progression, on a level going up?
I can't say that's $1 million question. Maybe that's $100,000 question because BMX is a hobby niche sport. I don't know. Like if you know Justin Travis at all, mm-hmm. he works for the Sanction New Track Development. Mm-hmm. He worked for me back in 03, 04, 05, actually lived at my house and he ran summer tour for me, did some transit stuff.
Yeah.
And we would be in the office racking our brains how to try to grow the sport when we started figuring stuff out, how do we grow sales? How do we build transit? How do we build market share? And we would get tangent on all these things of like, hey, BMX needs to get bigger. And, you know, we realized we got to get inside the sanction because Justin actually got a job offer from the NBL to work for the NBL. And he worked for the NBL for a few years. And then, you know, and now he's working at ABA. But I remember Tedesco was running NBL at the time. And, you know, if you know Tedesco, he was always had his hat on super duper low, covering his eyes, and he'd be like, now Styles, this is my Bob Tedesco impersonating Styles. You know, we're looking to hire an old Justin to work for us, but I don't want to take him from you if it's going to hurt you. And I'm like, Bob, Justin can do more for my business working for you guys than he can working for me. Because the only way my brand Transit's going to sell more is if BMX gets bigger. And the only way BMX can get bigger is if the sanction changes stuff and does stuff. And maybe this is the best it can ever be.
Wow.
Maybe this is the biggest BMX racing can ever be. It's not the 80s anymore. You know, I mean, to race BMX takes a lot of parental commitment. A lot of parental commitment.
Yeah.
Soccer, not as much. I mean, you got a soccer team with 15 kids. You only need parental commitment out of one parent that's going to be the coach. And maybe a team mom.
Yeah, a team you know mom driver.
Whereas with BMX, you got 15 kids racing BMX. Unless they have to share the same parent, every parent has to be involved for that kid to race BMX. Until maybe he turns 16, 17, and go do it on his own. But parental involvement's a big thing. And that's the thing, like BMX racing has a strong family base because it is truly a family sport. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's out there doing it together. It's not like one thing my dad said he liked about BMX is when my kids played soccer, my brother was older than me. We played on two different fields, sometimes in two different cities at the same time. You can't watch both kids play the game. BMX, everybody's at the same track. So grandpa, parent, grandkid, can all race the same track. Grandpa can watch the grandkid. Grandkid can watch grandpa. They can all watch mom and dad race if they want to race. So everybody's at the same place. You got five kids. You can watch all five kids race without having to get up and go to a different field or different whatever. Everybody, so that you got that family unit. And I mean, we don't have, like, what's divorce rate? I mean, what's single parenthood? Single parent, I don't know how single parents do BMX unless you're like independently wealthy or do whatever. You know, I mean, when I first started racing BMX, I mean, I went with one of my friend's moms, took us everywhere. Her husband made good money. She was a stay-at-home mom, and she took us everywhere. And that was my way to get around everywhere. I just tagged in with her and my friend, you know? So it's like, I kind of had that. My mom didn't have to go to races. My dad would take me here and there. And when my dad started taking me to races, it was more, he wanted to spend time with me. So for him, it was, hey, I was like 15, 16 at the time. My brother was 19, 20 at the time. And my dad realized like, oh, my first son is already an adult. My second son's getting close to that. I want to spend some time with him.
Yeah.
He's into BMX. I'm going to go to BMX races with him.
Tell me this. Are you riding at all?
Yeah, I still ride when I can. I still do the bike parks when I can. I had a pretty bad crash back Labor Day weekend, and I haven't really mentally recovered. Physically, I'm kind of getting better, but I was in the hospital. I had to get a blood transfusion.
Dang.
So it was pretty bad. Yeah, I was trying to ride up. I had a bruise that went from my knee all the way up to my chest and wrapped all the way around. It was a huge bruise. Anybody that's friends with me saw the pictures online. Dang. It was from my knee up to my chest, around to my belly button, lower back area. I crashed real hard. I was on blood thinners, so I bruised a lot easier. So that kind of hurt. And eventually I went to the hospital because I got to go pee and fainted twice. And the second time it's like, okay, I got to go to the hospital now. You know,
do you miss the racing at all? I mean, you were A pro at one time, vet pro. Do you miss the racing at all? And would you ever consider coming back?
I don't ever see myself racing ever again. My last race was 2012. And it's just getting out. I mean, there's a lot of time and effort that puts into it, you know, to be able to race at a top level. But actually, I work for Tim Daniels, who is the father of Dominique Daniels. If you know who Dominique Daniels is, five-time ABA national number one pro. In fact, another trivia question. She's the only person to win the ABA and NBL pro title, women's pro title in the same year. And she did it twice. She's one of the few that have won both in her career, but she won the ABA and NBL pro title in the same year.
She was the young lady that didn't like to jump.
Yeah, she didn't really jump well. But I get talking to her one time and we were doing like, yeah, dude, so what BMX injuries you got, you know? And she's like, dude, my back. Like, she's like, it wasn't like I had these crashes, I broke an arm, I did this, I did that. It was like, my back hurts from doing gates. It's like, I mean, gates are very hard on your back. If you think about the actual mechanics and physiology that goes into doing gates, it's extremely stressful on your back. And if your back's hurting a little bit, you can't do a gate.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so I think about, anytime I think about doing a gate, my back hurts. If I think about doing a gate, my back hurts. So you have to do a lot just to keep your core intact so you don't blow your back. I mean, I actually did break my back at Okeechobee back in 95, I think.
Jeez.
1995, I was there for a state race at a rhythm section. I nosed a jump, went OTB. I 50-50 the peak of the next jump with my back.
Ooh.
And I was out of commission for a little while, and I went to a doctor. He had me walk on my heels and he's like, okay, you know, nothing's pinching. He didn't pinch a nerve. And then like 7 or 8 years later, I was dealing with back issues all the time. I went to a chiropractor. He took an x-ray. He's like, yep, you broke your vertebrae right there. Oh. And he showed on the x-ray. I'm like, yep, that's where I hit the jump. So I just fractured a vertebrae, you know? So I've always dealt with back issues for a long time. And that's the thing is if I think it was Chad Roberts actually talked about, like, he suffers from BMX back or BMX knees, you know? Like anybody out there's like, yeah, dude, I got BMX back. And BMXers know what we're talking about when we say that.
Yeah.
They know, like, yeah, doing gates, man, is hard on you. If you don't properly warm up before you get into doing gates, you're running the risk of blowing your back out. Like, really get that thing loose. And once your back goes, it's tough. Over.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree. It's tough. And yeah. So the idea of doing a gate and racing doesn't seem that exciting to me anymore. I don't know how I did it. Like I go out, like I said, I go out to the Winter Nationals and I'm there just on Saturday. I went to a few nationals probably 7 or 8 years ago, but it was just to drop stuff off. You're still screen printing and doing jerseys, you know, like Vegas had a race and we had to go drop off stuff for some different companies and different teams.
Yeah.
And I go up there to drop stuff off and come back. But it's just like, I'm out the track. I'm like, man, how did I do this back in the day? How did I enjoy spending 12 to 14 hours at a track 3 days in a row, you know, like, that's why I said, if you like riding your bike, racing sucks. Going back to Denver, this guy, Sean Dupree, Raul Gomez.
Oh, I know, yeah, I know both.
They were doing some bike trips, and Sean kind of put out, hey, we're going, you know, I'm going to Denver, you know, because Lance McGuire was living there. So he's like, I'm going to crash at his house, ride some bike parks. He yep. kind of did it. We had like 30 dudes show up. And Sean just had like four or five guys going, and then a bunch of guys were like, hey, can I come? Can I come? Can I come? And we're out there. We're riding. So he flew in on Thursday, got back, put their bikes together, went out to the first bike park Thursday night. We're 2 hours into the session on Thursday night, and we still got all day Friday, all day Saturday, and a part of day Sunday to go. But we're 3 hours into the Thursday night session, or 2 hours into it, and he goes, dude, I've already ridden more today than I would have if I was in a national all weekend. Like 3 hours, I've already put more saddle time in 2 hours of this Thursday night session than I would if I was in a national all weekend. Because how many practice laps do you get? Well, now if you go on Saturday, you don't get any. Yeah. But, you know, if you show up Friday, you might get 5 or 6 practice laps.
That's what I was thinking.
You know, how many laps do you race? You qualify first moto, you have a semi and a main, you got 3. I mean, race laps, unless you race other bikes, you know, you're not getting much time on the track. My last couple of years racing vet, I should have probably turned back down to amateur. But the reason I didn't do it is amateur racing didn't appeal to me.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
And here's another thing, too. I know this is going to sound weird to some people, but like Tyler Farrow said the same thing. I've never raced a transfer system.
Really?
I grew up in Florida. It was NBL. NBL. By the time I started racing ABA, I was already racing A-Pro.
Yeah, and the only ABA track Florida, was Oldsmar, I think.
That came way out. I was already A-Pro by the time Oldsmar hit. When I first started racing, actually the first time I went to the track to ride, went to Orlando for a Sunday practice. And the Sunday practice was canceled because the ABA track that was 200 yards away from the NBL track was having a race. So they canceled the practice at the NBL track. And I think the same kind of people ran it. And then right after that race was over, they flattened the track. It was like the last race they ever had. And what's funny is the current track now, Orlando's current track, is actually where the old ABA track used to be.
Wow.
Because they moved the track. I had a friend of mine that got back into racing, and he raced in the early 90s, and he got back into racing. He got kids now. A lot of people do that. They get kids, so second generation comes, and he's like, is it weird? Like, am I off, or did they move the track? I'm like, yeah, they moved the track. They moved the track 200 yards from where it was. There was something with the land they needed for the Orlando track. They moved it, and it's actually where the old ABA track used to be. And then they had an ABA track in Ocoee, which was East Orlando, that lasted for about 6 months. And I was still racing novice intermediate at the time.
Oh, okay.
And then it flipped NBL. When I turned expert, it flipped NBL. So I raced some NBL there. And then Powder Springs, Georgia. The first time I raced there, it was NBL. I raced there in 91, and it was an NBL track. You know, Margie Hatfield's track?
Yeah.
Powder Springs, Cobb County BMX?
Yeah.
In 91, it was an NBL track.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It was NBL, and then it flipped ABA, and that was about 8.5 hours from my house. So 94, it flipped ABA, or 93. 92, 93 is when it flipped ABA, and that would have been the closest track to my house at 8.5 hours away. So it's like, I grew up, and by the time I finally got to race ABA, I mean, I was never really that good. If I was good, like if I was a superstar, I might have got picked up by a factory team and race some ABA, you know, because you got guys like Percy Owens. There's a lot of Florida guys. They were really good, and they got kind of became ringers. David Milham raced for GT, and he started racing. I mean, I guess he had his local, that local ABA track, but, you know, and then Percy Owens was a Sarasota local, hardcore NBL, but that boy was fast.
Yeah, I keep trying to get him, and I can't get him, man.
Oh, dude, you ain't gonna beat Percy. I actually beat him once.
No. Racing. I mean, I want to interview him.
Oh, you want to interview him?
Yeah, man. That dude,
Man, he is an awesome interview. He's funny. He reminds me of Emmett Smith. I've told him that a few times. Like how Emmett Smith talks.
Yeah.
Like if I hear Emmett Smith, I always think it's Percy. Get some good Spider-Man. You ever met Percy's mom?
No, I met Percy when I lived down here in Orlando. I was at some state races and I met him. And he was really cool. And I reached out to him when I started the podcast, and I haven't heard from him since, but I would love to get him and just talk to him, pick his brain.
Yeah. I always ask people, have you ever met Percy's mom? And if they say, I don't know, then you haven't met him.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think
his
I have.
Mom could, it looks, he looks exactly like his mom.
Oh, that's funny.
He sounds exactly like his mom. Like, think of Percy as a female, and that's his mom. It's awesome when you find it, you meet her. But, you know, like, those guys were really good, so they got picked up, and they would race the ABA National Series.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was never good, so nobody ever wanted to come cherry pick me. You know, so then if I raced ABA, it was kind of hard living in Florida in the early 90s to race ABA when your local track's 8.5 hours away. You know, so by, and I turned pro in 94, so by the time I didn't race my first ABA race, I think since 96 or 97, me and Domingos actually went to Raleigh. That's Domingos Lamoglia.
Yeah, that's my dude.
Yeah, that was that. I think that was both of our first ABA race. There was a national in Raleigh, and we road tripped up there together and hit it up. But that was, you know, so I was already racing A pro by the time. And that's the thing, like, looking at racing amateur, the transfer system just doesn't seem like it'd be that exciting. Vet pro, they scramble motos. You can have 8 guys on a gate, and they scramble motos. So you're racing a different guy each time. Anybody that's raced the world qualifiers kind of has a feeling for what scrambled motos is like, because you're racing somebody different. Yeah. You know, and you're always battling to the line every single time. It's not like transfer system first moto, you come out in fourth, they're only taking 1 or 2. You just sit down like, I'll get it next round. You know, whereas when you're racing total points, you're sitting in fourth, you want to pass third. Because that gets you a better chance. Because if you get fourth the first moto, crash the second moto, now you're sitting on 10 points, 12 points, you're probably not going to qualify. So every little spot counts. So you're battling the whole time. And that's why I didn't really want to go to amateur, you know, race amateur. I'm like, and I get 3 motos. It's like racing bet pro was way more fun.
Yeah.
And I could get pro practice. So I didn't have to be there at whatever time to get practice. I could go out there and get some pro practice. And I got to race my first, it was just way more fun to race vet pro than it was to race amateur. Or I mean, I don't know. I didn't race amateur coming back, but it just didn't seem that appealing to me to race. I know I talked to Ray Hudson, and he goes, I'd rather race than chase, which that kind of happened in vet pro. You had some dudes I couldn't touch.
Yeah.
You know, like, there was like, you'd watch it, you'd see like 4 fast dudes, and then like, or maybe 3 or 4 fast dudes battling for the win. And then you'd see a mid-pack battling for 3rd through 4th. And then 2 moto fills at the back, you know?
Yeah.
And it was a distinct. It wasn't like the guy in 4th wasn't that close to 3rd. Like, you could tell those 3 dudes are so much faster than everybody else. It's almost like we're racing our own lap, you know?
Mm.
You know, type of deal. But, yeah. Yeah, Spider-Man would be a good guy to get on if you could get Percy on. We were the same age a couple times. I had three really good Spider-Man stories. First year racing expert, I went to Christmas Classic, and we had a stacked moto. Percy was in there, Gary DeBacker was in there, and somebody else. And everybody kind of balled up and almost crashed in the first straightaway. And my brother was filming me, so he has me centered on the picture. And you see Percy, like, slip pedals, almost crashed, got back on his bike, and he kind of went down a picture frame. And then you see him come into the picture frame. And then by the finish line, he was out of the picture frame in front of me. So it was like, my brother, like, that's just how fast that boy was. You know, that was a good one. And one year I beat him at Okeechobee. It was kind of weird. The last turn, they had an S turn, and the last straightaway was really long.
Yeah.
And I just went in, and we were racing A Pro. I think it was a Florida State race. And I kind of bumped in the last turn, and then it was a drag race last straightaway, and I beat him to the line. It was kind of weird because I was like, dude, I just beat Percy to the line. Like, that dude's better than me. That shouldn't happen. Then a couple of years later, Spider-Man told me, he was like, I know, man. I remember that race. I crossed the finish line and said, dude, Style Man beat me. I got to get on my train. That shouldn't happen. You know, I'm kind of like, in a way, he kind of dogged me, but I'm like, I understood it. But I was like, man, you really got to say that to me. Like, really?
That's pretty good.
And then another good Percy Owen story I had, we were racing Rockford, and he was coming back into AA, and he was starting to make some moves. It was actually on Transit Race 3. Pro opened on Sunday. Well, Rockford, you come out of last turn, they had the doubles they call the tombstones.
Yep.
And the reason it was called the tombstones is the dirt they got, or the last turn they called it the graveyard turn. Because it used to be a flat 180, like totally flat.
Yeah.
And then they got dirt from a graveyard, and that's what they used to build that turn. So they called it the graveyard turn, and they had some dirt left over. So they built some doubles out of that turn. They called the tombstones. Wow. Interesting little story, some that's graveyard crazy. Dirt.
Yeah, yeah.
But they had some double out of the last turn. I was watching Percy race pro open or double A, and he jumped the double. And I see him in the pits. I'm like, yo, dude, pull manual, that jump out of the last turn, it's faster. And so then pro open made on Sunday, Paulie Lang was winning, or Jackal was winning, and Paulie Lang was trying to pass him and balled up. And then Percy was like in fourth, pulled manual it, pulled, got away into second. I saw him after the race. I'm like, man, that was cool. You got second. And he goes, I know, dude. I pulled manual that double out of last turn. And I just felt the boost. And Percy goes, style, man, hook me up. You know, if you know his the way he said it, it was kind of funny. He was just like, he pulled that and he was like, damn, that was faster. Thanks a lot, style, man. That was cool. But,
all right, tell me this. Where do you see yourself the next 5 to 10 years?
Hopefully I'm still alive. I don't know how my health is going to be. I get weird stuff here and there, who knows, but hopefully I'm still working. I don't know if I'll still be delivering Amazon or not. Who knows? I don't know if I'll still be living in Arizona. My daughter's a junior now when she graduates. I don't know. There's a lot of up in the air the next 5 years. Hopefully, yeah. I'm still riding my bike. I kind of had a goal that if I hit 60 years old, I can still maybe ramp some jumps, yeah. Like a decent jump line, you know. But we'll see on that. Maybe do a little bit better. That's the weird thing is if the bike parts get built, I don't know how long it'll take for them to get built in Phoenix. Maybe I can kind of knock the rust off and keep my line. Because whenever I go to Colorado, what's good is the bike jumps don't really change much. So like, hey, I made this section last year. I kind of already know what it's like. I don't have to learn it as much.
Yeah.
And then, but I spend like the first day kind of knocking off the rust, maybe second day. And then by the third day, I'm kind of, okay, by the fourth day, it's like, okay, do I want to push a little bit harder? You know, but then it's a year later till I get to ride again, you know, or really ramp decent stuff again. Or if I can make some trips here and there. So it's like, how much do I lose? And how long it's taking to build up. Whereas if I had something locally to ride, like if I had the Boise Bike Park, that's one of the best bike parks out there. You know, Boise, Idaho. If you guys are ever there, bring your bike, check out the Boise Bike Park downtown. If you're ever in Denver, look up Valmont, Ruby Hill, Frisco. If you go into the mountains, Minturn, depending on where you want to jump.
Yeah.
So hopefully I'm still riding. That's the thing, is riding my bike is fun. Like I fell in love with riding again. After I quit racing, I hated BMX for a little while. I've always had a love-hate relationship with BMX, but I kind of hated it for a little while. And then I fell in love with riding again about 5 years ago.
Not bad.
I was able to get some local bike parks to start ramping again. And it's just like, that's all I do. I'm not trying to chase racing. I think that's one thing I was just too busy trying to chase BMX racing. It's a full-time job to really chase it.
Yeah.
To really try to get on the national circuit and do it. Like, it's hard. It takes a lot. And you lose a little bit. Whereas riding, you can kind of still keep it going and you can do it whenever you want. You know, if you have the right places to ride, you know, type of deal. So, yeah, I have no idea where I'll be in 5 to 10 years. Maybe I'll be living in Bentonville, Arkansas. I've never been there before. But, you know, it's kind of the mountain bike capital of the world. Anybody that's into mountain biking knows.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Bentonville's the home of Walmart. Sam Walton, he's got heirs, grandkids that are worth hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. I heard they dropped like $120 million to build mountain bike trails because one of the kids got into mountain biking.
Yeah.
So they put up this fund to build mountain bike trails everywhere. So maybe I can live there. Maybe live someplace to just be. Have a good lifestyle. I mean, I like Phoenix. There's a lot of good stuff in Phoenix, but I don't know if this is where I need to stay long-term. But I know I'm not going anywhere for 2 years until my daughter graduates high school at least, and then kind of go from there. When I had my daughter, I kind of knew when she turned 5, the road trip, the BMX was going to kind of be done, you know, and going that way. I'll actually be in Florida in a couple weeks.
You got to let me know.
Just an evening. It's March 9th. We're going out of Miami. Yeah, so we'll be a little south, but doing a cruise, Royal Caribbean, heading up. My daughter, it's weird. She has 2 weeks of spring break this year instead of 1 week. So we're going to go out of Miami, do 2 weeks there, and then head up to see my dad for a couple days and then fly back home. But yeah, so it's more just kind of spending time with my daughter when I can, trying to build a retirement. All those years of doing the BMX business, never having a day job, never putting into retirement. I finally started doing it. I'm up to like 20 grand in retirement. I only have another 500, 600 to go, you know. Hopefully I can get, I'm about to turn 50. You know, people be calling the police here in 2 months, the big 5-0, you know. But so if I can retire at 65, I got 15 years to try to build a retirement. And that's the thing, guys. If you're going to do BMX, make sure you have a job and you're still putting away for retirement. Don't put all your eggs in the BMX basket, business-wise, professional-wise.
Yeah.
You know, like Cam Moore, I feel sorry for that kid. I just read that he tore his labrum again. He's going to miss the Olympics.
Yep.
You know, now it's up to Cameron Larson. You know, Cameron Larson's our best shot on the men's side to win an Olympic medal. You know, and on the women's side, Elise is still there and Felicia has a chance, and who knows what Peanut's going to do, you know, but it's like, I mean, BMX has gotten international.
Yes, it has.
It's crazy. You know about 1995, the controversy, the 1995 ABA Pro Championship?
No.
A rider went into the 95 ABA Grands in the pro points, leading pro points, won the main event at the Grands, and went home national number two.
How does that work?
ABA had a rule that you had to be a U.S. citizen to win the title. So he wasn't allowed to win the title because he was a Frenchman. So who was that? Do you know who that was?
Levesque.
Levesque should have won the 95 pro title instead of Gary Ellis. Ellis didn't even make the main. That was the year Brian Foster had a chance to win, but he slid out and hit the hay bale in the last turn. And the person who was super relieved at that moment was Mike King. Because Mike King just picked up a ride with GT for racing mountain bikes, but he raced BMX here and there.
Yeah.
And Mike King was ordered to take out Brian Foster. He was Duke bested. If you watch the movie Rad, you better take out that kid. He was ordered to take out Brian Foster so Brian wouldn't win the title and Gary Ellis would win the title. Interesting little thing. And it's interesting to know that if Brian Foster didn't hit the hay bale and Mike King was right behind him going the last turn, would Mike King have cut the track and taken out Brian Foster? So Ellis would have won the title because GT wanted to have the number one pro. And then after that year, ABA changed their rules to where you didn't have to be a U.S. citizen to win the ABA pro title.
Not bad.
And
not
since bad. Then, more foreigners have won the ABA pro title than Americans.
That is true. That is true.
And another crazy thing, when was the last time an ABA-born rider won the AA pro title? A guy who started racing BMX in the ABA won the AA men's pro title.
I couldn't tell you.
We mentioned him earlier. Trivia question.
Connor Fields.
Nope. Connor grew up. He started NBL. And the last of the American to win it before him was Randy Stumphauser, who he grew up NBL too.
Jason Richardson?
No. He won the cruiser and AA pro title.
Right.
Danny Cowlog. That was 2007.
Right,
the last time somebody who started racing ABA won the ABA USA BMX pro title was 2007. Think about that.
That's crazy.
You know, Bubba Harris won it before Kellogg. I mean, Bubba won it early days. But yeah, I mean, the last three Americans to win, Connor won it three times.
Yep.
Stumpy won it in 09. Kellogg won in 07. Other than that, it's been a foreigner. I mean, a Frenchman won it. Since they changed the rule, Levesque won it two more times. I really see Levesque having three ABA pro titles, even though in the record books it says two.
Yeah.
And then Joris won it five times. Willoughby won it three times. Wade Boots won it once.
Yep.
Kalen Young won it once. Warwick Stevenson won it twice.
Yep.
Mark Willers won. So you got Australia, New Zealand, that's like six or seven there, you know? And then you got,
Doris at,
you know, France a bunch, and then Stromberg's won it once.
Yep.
Dang. A lot of foreigners have won it. So BMX is truly international. And you kind of look at it as like, where's the, I mean, Americans supposed to be dominating BMX, but are they, you know? On the women's side, you know, Elise Willoughby's been holding down the fort. But
yeah.
But think about it. 1997, Michelle Carnes won the pro women's title. 20 years later, an American woman finally won the UCI world's title. And that was Elise Willoughby, Elise Post. Think about that. 20 years where a U.S. woman did not win the world title. Kind of crazy when you think about that. Yeah. Only three American women have ever won the UCI or IBMXF World Pro title. Elise did it twice. Felicia did it once.
Stancil.
And then Michelle Carnes. Michelle Carnes is the only woman to win the ABA, NBL, and UCI pro titles in her career. Elise never won the NBL title. She would have won it if she went after it, but she never chased it.
Yeah.
You know, but, and she finally won the Worlds twice. She won, she was half lap world's title like three times, but then she crashed, you know, four times. But yeah. But on the men's side, it's like in the amateur ranks, we still do good, but we're not producing top pros on the American side. It's been a long time. Corbin and Connor and Nick Long were the last three, you know, and Cam Woods kind of taking the mantle, and then Cam Larson stepped it up this year. So
he's come along a long way.
I don't know who else is going to do. I thought Cedric Sade or Cade was going to maybe step up there, but where has he been? I haven't seen him. You know, it's like, who's going to be the next guy? France, they keep producing. I mean, France podiumed the world last year.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, the Olympics this year is in Paris, France. There's a very good chance the podium at the Olympics is going to be three Frenchmen. Making the French team is going to be hard. There's only going to be three men, Frenchmen that are going to make the Olympic team. Yeah. Joris is going to have a spot. Mayhew's going to have a spot.
Mayhew will have one. Yeah. And then
Sylvain Andre.
No, he's injured.
I mean, there's four or five dudes that can make it.
Nah, I think it's probably eight.
Yeah. It's like the Olympics in 08. There was five men that could have made the Olympic team in 08.
Rencorel, Racine.
In 08, like you had Stumphauser was up there. Bubba was up there. Kyle Bennett, Mike Day, Donnie Robinson, Steven Cesar. Those six guys were the main six that all had a chance to make the 08 Olympic team. Only three could go.
Yep.
Steven Cesar, 2008 World Championships. Mayor Stromberg wins. Steven Cesar gets second. At the World Championships in 08, 3 months before the Olympics, and Steven Cesar doesn't make the Olympic team. He's the alternate. Like, how crazy is that to be second in the world and not be able to make the Olympic team?
Yeah.
That's how stacked it was back then. He was the odd man out. It went Donnie, Mikey, and Kyle Bennett. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Colin Stiles, I want to say thank you for coming on the Lane 8 BMX podcast. I really appreciate it.
And hopefully I didn't waste people's time that listened to this show.
You did not.
That's the thing. Like with Brian staying at the house, there was three different times where we're talking about some crazy trivia, BMX knowledge, history. And he's like, you realize nobody in the world really cares. Like very few people know what we're talking about. So I talked about a lot of stuff that people are going to be totally clueless on. But you got Google, go back, look at stuff like TRA BMX, check out the dual slalom races. Stuff like that. Look up bike parks. Pretty soon the bike park revolution is going to take over. There's going to be 1,000 bike parks in the country in the next 10 years, hopefully. Going to be more places to ride your bike. Go out there, work on your skills, get it down, take it to the BMX track, have fun. And BMX is a hobby niche sport.